This episode of Zero Block 30 is brought to you by the CW Network's Valor. Their new show, Valor, is taking over fucking TV everywhere. Two special ops army helicopters with special operation helicopter pilots breaking boundaries and defying all expectation. Their bravery in the face of impossible odds earned them the distinguished Flying Cross for Valor. But together, they're finding that the truth is the first casualty of war. During their first mission, something went wrong. Something no one is talking about. And when they... Well, I don't know why I'm saying this like The Rock. And when they went to the combat zone, not everyone came home. So now they have secrets. But they're also patriots and refuse to leave any man behind. What would you do if you had to break the rules and do what was right? Would you stay grounded? Would you step in line or go to any lengths to earn their truth? Their secrets are safe. If they go on a clandestine mission, they risk their life and limbs with only each other to depend on. How close would you get to the only person who really knows you? It's the explosive new drama that pushes the boundaries between military discipline and human nature. The new series that's right on target. It's Valor. There's new episodes Monday at 9, 8 Central, after all new episodes of Supergirl. Only on the Charlie... That sounded deep and nice. Supergirl. Only on Charlie Whiskey, Charlie Whiskey, the CW. Watch Valor. Hit the theme music.
Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the...
Well, welcome to Zero Block 30. I am Uncle Chaps. I am actually in the studio with Radio Brand and Captain Cons. We are back from Washington, where we have an interview that you're going to hear later with Congressman Seth Moulton of Massachusetts, who is a United States Marine before he was a congressman. He's a captain, all-around great guy. And I wanted to start off the show, Cons, by saying I was happy, 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 Marine Corps happy, about one little element of his office. Do you remember what it was?
Hold on. Let me think about it. No, I can't think of what you might have been happy about. What?
The liquor cabinet.
Oh, right, yes, you did
mention
that. I
talked about the liquor cabinet so much that when I was a young troop, and the first time I knew I had made it as a young enlisted man was whenever I was brought into my captain's office, and he was like, would you like a drink? And I'm thinking, like, it's weird that you're offering me a water, sir. Like, this is weird. He's like, no, do you want a whiskey? And we go into Seth Moulton's office yesterday, and the very first thing when I sit down on the couch, I recognize that he has a few bottles of scotch and a couple bottles of American whiskey. And I was like, my man.
Yeah, it looked like it was good stuff, too.
And he had it hidden, just like a Marine Corps captain would, behind his little pitcher. There was a couple bottles, but I saw the little head sneaking out. I'm like a little mouse when I know that there's a little piece of cheese in there, and that cheese is whiskey. So it was a great time.
No, it was very professional. It was very professional.
I would say, is my mic on?
We have Brendan trying to talk, and his mic's not even on. There
I would say that that's actually your second part. The couch that was in the West Wing might have been your favorite part of it.
But that
office
was in Kinzinger, which we'll get to next week. That was in Kinzinger's office.
Gotcha. I just remember that.
It was Moulton's office that had the liquor.
But yeah, you know, it's not 1965 anymore. It's not very appropriate to have liquor just strewn about your office. So I did respect his professionalism to keep it hidden.
And I did think it was funny whenever we were in Kinzinger's office how they're like, well, we have to have on a certain news station because he belongs to a certain party where, and the Democratic Party's like, fuck it, we'll just have booze in the office.
Let's yeah, exactly.
A little bit more loosey-goosey.
There were a lot of little tidbits like that that I thought were interesting that maybe you see on TV or movies, but then when you actually see it in real life and you see, like you mentioned, all right, we have to have it on a certain channel because that's the channel that our constituents watch.
Right, and it's a thing that no one really gives a fuck about in real life, but politicians have to worry about, like, every single thing. When I was down in Jacksonville with Francis a couple of weeks ago, one of the TV stations there, one of the women who works there, her husband is also a congressman, and they have to worry about the dumbest shit. Like, whenever somebody like me who comes on that might, like, say a cuss word or might have an inappropriate dick joke or tit joke or something like that, she won't even go on the radio or TV with that person because it reflects poorly on her husband if she's there because of what people are worried about in the political process. And let me just say this. That is dumb as fuck.
It is, but that's the viral world that we live in. People will take the dumbest little thing. They would take something like, oh, we went into, you know, so-and-so's office and it was on CNN versus Fox News and they would run with that, and people would have a field day. And that's just the world we live in, and it's
annoying. It's a dumb, dumb world.
It's childish.
It's a dumb, dumb world. It's just so stupid to have to fucking deal with it. Another thing that's come up, it's a big thing that's happening right now. Sean Hannity had Trump on his show, President Trump on his show.
They're at a
military base. They were sitting in a hangar, and for those that don't know what a hangar is, I mean, you have to probably be a stupid person not know what a hangar is. But a hangar is like where an airplane goes whenever it goes to bed. It's like a garage for airplanes. Mm-hmm. So whenever they're sitting in there...
I'm sorry, you say that and I just think of like a Disney movie with the plane has eyes and a mouth and a personality and talks.
Well, they do. So, I mean, that's the reason why they have like birds and shit painted on them. So when they go in there, they're sitting there with the door of the hangar wide open. So you can see the outside. Technically, they're not outside.
Technically.
So this is a big technicality for military people because everybody on who really, really loves President Trump for everything that he does, they're not going to admit that anything they're going to find a technicality out of it.
True.
And the technicality was the reason why he didn't stand for the retreat, which we play at the end of every single Zero Block 30 show. So that's how you know what that sound is. It means it's over, like the day's over. Mm-hmm. The commanding officer of the installation is the one that dictates what time the retreat goes. And it's usually around sunset. It can be at any time the commander dictates it.
Sure.
It could be at 1630, it could be at 1700, whatever. Usually it's around 1920 is the time that you're going to play the retreat. That's the time that Hannity was on.
And lower the flag.
So you have a big ceremony, no matter what's going on. And it might not be a huge ceremony, but there's at least five people there.
Yep. Yeah. There's the bugler. I can't say that.
I mean, most don't do it with an actual bugle anymore. They play like the loudspeaker.
Oh, yeah. No, sure. But yeah, and then there's, you know, guys actually taking the flag down, and then there's going to be guys who are actually going to fold the flag. Yeah, it's not many, but it's a few.
So they're taking down the flag to fold it up, to put it up properly, because you don't leave, like, on a garrison installation, you don't leave the colors up, the flag up, for 24/7. Mm-hmm. It might rain, and you have a storm flag, you have all different kinds of flags. So you just take it down, and then you start it up at the beginning of the next day, usually at daybreak. 0600 is usually when they start out, maybe a little bit later on other type of bases. Anyways, so they're doing their interview. And the retreat starts to play. Well, the appropriate military response when retreat goes is what, Cons?
You stop what you're doing. You stop conversation. You face the flag. You stand at attention. And then as it's lowered, you render a salute. If you're a civilian, you just stand there quietly and respect that the flag is coming down. But it's something that happens on military installations and right away incites fear in a lot of guys.
So what he means there is that military people in general hate standing at attention. Mm. Like, you just do. So if you can get away with not standing at attention, you 100% will. So this is the type of issue where if you're going now, like, people who usually follow my political camp will be like, President Trump doesn't respect the flag. In reality, I think he just didn't know.
That's what I would say, too.
What it was, which is not an excuse.
When you're the commander in chief,
it's not an excuse.
Right.
And there's been people on the other side like, well, he had one earpiece to talk to security, one earpiece to talk to Hannity. He commented on the fucking sound.
Yeah.
Like, he heard what the sound was.
Yeah, exactly. He says, that for you or for me?
And they made jokes about it.
Right.
That's not appropriate to do. I think everybody realizes that is appropriate. Where we've got to get past in the political process in this country, where if because you have an R by your name or you have a D by your name, you are going to immediately have the automatic take of what you should.
Right.
I think President Trump just didn't know. I think he was ignorant to what the sound was.
And I think also, too, he probably was thinking, oh, I'm on a television show. It's not right if I just stop talking to Mr. Hannity right now and stand up and face the flag.
I don't think that's it. I think that if he realized what it actually was, he could have fucking slam dunked all of his NFL tweets and how much he's been talking about the flag.
Oh, about respect
the flag?
Yeah.
If he recognized what it was,
the
TV show wouldn't have mattered fucking at fuckle. Like, it wouldn't
No, no, I agree. But he didn't have any idea. It was very clear that he didn't have any idea what was going on.
I'm saying, like, he missed a golden opportunity being there.
Oh, absolutely.
And they could have set it up where it was beautiful.
Oh, yeah, like, look what Trump did.
Hold on, Sean. Let's respect the flag.
Right.
And they could have done it on TV, and it would have been... You would have Make America Great Again would have been trending for the next 18 years.
Yes.
Like, people would have been like, oh my God, a Freedom Boner. Oh!
And then you used an example in your blog that you wrote today when that clip of Robin Williams from years ago. He was on a USO tour, and they were sounding retreat on the base, and everybody in the audience, which was all military, who was facing him, stood up, turned their backs to him, and Robin Williams didn't know what was going on, but he just was quiet because
you figure
that was,
it out.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But then, you know, maybe shame on Hannity, too, that he doesn't know. He kept talking to him.
I don't think the shame goes on anybody except for the president in that moment. Because Hannity is not responsible for guiding President Trump in political process or military traditions. He's the commander-in-chief. And this whole idea that he's new at it now, no. He's been at it for 9 months.
More than that. I guess technically, since office. Okay, all right, yeah.
He's been in office for like 9 or 10 months, whatever it is. You gotta know.
Yeah, you gotta know.
And if he doesn't know, you can place some blame on General Kelly. You can place some blame there. But in reality, he's gotta know. The growing period is done.
Listen, I've said a few different people here you can blame. Ultimately, we always talk about leaders being good leaders is taking responsibility. The blame game just needs to disappear, and he needs to just say, hand up, I should have known better.
Yeah.
And that would go a long way, too.
That's an easy thing to do.
It's an easy win.
40 times a day, dude. Just come out one time and be like, I made a mistake last night. I want to apologize to anybody that I might have offended. And the idea that you're going to be offended about that is fucking stupid anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not offended by that. I've served. You've served. I don't give a shit.
Like, right.
Because
that would be like if, you know, back when we were in the military, you're driving on post, and if you got caught during retreat and you got out of your car and then saw one of your buddies driving and ignoring retreat and getting pissed at him. It's not the right thing to do, but are you going to lose sleep over it?
And in reality, do you even really fucking care?
Nah,
like,
exactly.
You really don't care. But as the president, as the commander-in-chief, especially on a military base, there is a requirement in all promotion warrants. I don't know if it's across the board, but for Marines, it says that you need to be above reproach.
Right.
That's not being above reproach. If you're going to harp on flag etiquette, national anthem etiquette, you better know it.
That's a great point. When you tie it into all the hullabaloo that he has been undertaking.
There's been some hullabaloo.
Hullabaloo has been abound with the NFL and the flag controversy. Then, yeah, you got to be
the
expert.
You can't fucking talk about Italian food and how great you are at Italian food all the time and then be seen at the Times Square Olive Garden. You can't do that. That's not what you can do. And that's essentially what happened. But anyways, moving on from President Trump, there's another little thing. We have in probably 2 weeks we're going to air this interview. We just recorded it now with Medal of Honor recipient Captain Flo Groberg. Recently, Secretary Mattis called one of the Medal of Honor recipients a Medal of Honor winner.
Yeah.
I don't care. I don't care. I don't remember the terms being so technical. While I was in boot camp, I swear to Christ, I think that I remember my drill instructors calling them Medal of Honor winners.
I've heard it interchangeably. I've heard it used interchangeably.
But now you say it and people act like you threw a brick at their dick. Like, grow up, dude. Like, stop being so technical. And we talk about this with Jack Higgins last week. Like, we have gone so far to military appreciation about everything. It's like we can't have a fucking brain.
Yeah. It's major and minor issues.
People are going to make mistakes. If Secretary Mattis, the Marine of the Marines for the last 40 years, calls it winner, I feel like you got to give Nancy Pelosi a little bit of a break when she says it.
Absolutely.
Or you got to give whoever on the right side a little bit of a break when they say it. Let's not be so – it's the respect that they're trying to give. Like when President Trump called the medal or Purple Heart recipient when he told him congratulations.
Right, yeah, and there was so much uproar.
He was trying to give the guy respect, to give the guy some attention for getting this award. That is majoring in minor shit, and it's making your last-ditch stand in the wrong fucking ditch.
Yeah.
If you're trying to render respect to somebody, I don't care if you mess – if the technetics – not even a word, but if the technetics behind it
are
fucked up. It's a good damn word. Like, to be a colloquialism, it's very, very good.
Let's adopt that, but you're absolutely right. And it's just – it's frustrating, and I have no patience for it anymore. It's just annoying, and – The conversation it ends as quickly as it starts because you're like, all right, great, that's dumb that you care about that. Let's move on.
Completely dumb. There was a point whenever we moved in to our interview with Seth Moulton, which we're going to play in just a minute. There was a point last week, scratch that, reverse it. There was a point in that interview where he said something that I couldn't disagree with more, and he said it, and I was kind of dumbfounded that he actually said it, that he doesn't believe that people should tell war stories because the public doesn't need to know or something like that. I forget how he phrased it
exactly.
Well,
I think where
he
was coming from,
he doesn't want it to be about him.
Right, and I think he was talking more about it from a political – I'm speculating here. I think he was talking about it more from a political standpoint that he doesn't want to be propped up by telling war stories, by running around and telling all the exploits of what he did in combat in his four tours in Iraq, which is – very admirable. He doesn't want that to become the narrative that who he is now.
Right, and I understand that, and I feel like him being in that position and saying something like that is kind of dangerous because I feel like that letting shit eat you alive and not talking about it at all, not being open, can lead down to dangerous paths. And I am 100% certain that that's not what Congressman Moulton means by it, but I wanted to clarify that before we actually play the interview, that that part was something that I don't agree with him at all. I tell my stories, and I'm proud to tell my stories because they highlight what other people do as well, and it makes me remember the people who are around me, and I tell those stories, and I tell them often.
I think it's important to note that, though. You tell them for the right reasons, and when it's that context, I think it's okay, and I agree with you. It's healthy for us.
And people in Congress can become, they can appear to be self-serving when they show those things.
Exactly. And again, it goes back to how they're going to be propped up by their constituents and the public. They're going to be seen as telling these war stories as a way to gain instant credibility and respect, when in fact, what we're saying is, it's just a way to highlight the service of the people you served with. It's healthy, as I just said. And also, too, I think it's important for people to understand what combat is really like and not what is just always on the news or in movies. It's important to hear that truth.
Yeah, I just remember distinctly before we got into the interview that that was something that kind of woke me up. And what else could wake me up is Dunkin's Cold Brew Coffee. They have a bunch of classic different flavors. There's the pumpkin cold brew that, you know, I'm a big pumpkin guy. It's full body. It's ultra smooth. It's cold brew coffee that now comes with a sweet taste of pumpkin. America runs on Dunkin'. Chaps runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. There's a limited time offer. Dunkin' Cold Brew meets classic fall flavors. Get those fall flavors before it turns into Christmas season, which is going to be before Thanksgiving, if I have anything to do with it. Here, for all of our listeners in Massachusetts, is your Congressman Seth Moulton.
Help, 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 right, help. Left, 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 right, left.
Well, if my drill instructors would know that the little idiot that they had that wouldn't amount of much would be know that we're sitting inside a congressman's office in D.C. doing Zero Block 30, where we're going to talk about smart people stuff. They wouldn't have believed it. And I don't think I would have either. But we are in D.C. with Congressman Seth Moulton. Thank you for coming on the show, sir. We really appreciate it.
Listen, if my drill instructors at OCS, at Quantico, had known that I'd be sitting here, I probably wouldn't have made it out of OCS. So
I think that's kind of how we all felt. I mean, it is very rare that you have three people in the same room who are from the greatest institutions like of higher learning in the country, with Connors representing West Point, you being a Harvard guy, me being a UTSA guy from San Antonio. There's nothing but prestige in the room. But we wanted to start out with, when you were a young man and you were going to Harvard, whenever I had leaders that went to Harvard or Yale or Princeton, and I would be like, why in the world did you decide to enlist or to become commissioned officer? How did you get there? How did you come to the point where you wanted to be a Marine?
You know, it's a little bit of a long story, but when I was at school, I spent a lot of time going to church. Not because I'm a super religious guy, but just because, frankly, I thought it made me a better person. And there were times in college when I needed a little bit of making me a better person, especially after, you know, a weekend out or whatever. So I was really influenced by the minister. His name was Reverend Professor Peter Gomes. And he was the minister at the church, but he was also this larger-than-life moral figure on campus, had one of the most popular courses. He talked a lot about the importance of service and about how it's not enough just to believe in service or support others who serve. You ought to go find a way yourself to give back. And I looked at my life, and I'm like, look, I'm incredibly fortunate to get here to Harvard. I got the scholarship so I could go here, but I never really done much to give back. So I looked at different options. I looked at Peace Corps, I looked at teaching overseas, but I just had so much respect at the end of the day for these 18, 19-year-old kids, some 17, as I learned, mm-hmm. when two 17-year-olds showed up to my platoon the night we were invading Iraq, who put their lives on the line for our country every day. And I was like, look, if they're willing to do that, then I ought to be willing to do that too. So I decided to sign up.
And I think it's important to note that you signed up before September 11th. You know, you see a lot of folks that will have that urge to serve post 9/11, understandably so. What was your feeling when you decided to serve in the Marines and then 9/11 happens?
You know, it's funny that same minister had a talk with me that spring of 2001 when I was graduating and said, you know, Seth, I think you're making this decision for the right reasons, but I'm just glad there's not a war going on because you'd probably get yourself killed. Mm. And I think he remembered that conversation every time I redeployed to Iraq. Mm-hmm. But when September 11th happened, look, I had a lot of friends who witnessed it firsthand because these were Harvard kids who'd gone to work on Wall Street. I mean, two of my roommates were literally living a block away. And yet they couldn't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. I was the only one who was in a position to actually do something about these attacks against our country. And I was proud of that. At a time when there were lines forming outside of recruiting stations, I was proud that I'd already signed up.
And I think that there's a lot of distinction because whenever people, we have a large amount of civilians who listen to the show, and when you picture somebody in Iraq, especially maybe somebody who's in a role of a congressman, a Harvard guy, like you're like, well, what did you actually do in Iraq? And when I was researching your story, I found it very interesting that you have a lot of accolades that you were pretty hesitant to talk about. Why was that?
Because I don't think, you know, veterans should tell war stories. I think those of us who've really, you know, been in the worst of it, we just know we were there to do our jobs and we were there to fight for the guys next to us. And that's not something to brag about. That's just doing your service to the country. So I didn't ever bring that stuff up in the campaign. But I think it's important to say that, you know, you understood, you heard why I signed up, because I had so much respect for these 18-year-old kids. Well, I wasn't going to be riding in a tank while some 18-year-old was slogging through the mud next to me. That's why I wanted to be in the infantry.
Okay. And I think that there, because we are a podcast that tells, like, the stories from our perspective of why we have the perspective. And I think that when I found out about your story, it gives credence whenever you have a story that, or whenever you're trying to pass a bill to ban bump stocks, whenever you talk about that, you've seen automatic weapon fire and seen what it can do. And we always talk about that it's important to have these stories out there so that the civilians know what war actually looks like.
You know, I wouldn't be here in Congress if not for the experience of the Marines. Don't think for a second that I was sitting there at Harvard saying, oh, I'll sign up for the Marines because I'll go to Congress. Mm. Trust me, I studied physics. That doesn't make me sound like a nerd. I don't know what does. had no interest in politics, didn't do any, you know, political volunteering or anything like that. And so I signed up just thinking I would do my 4 years of service and that would be it. And that'd be the last government paycheck I would get. But instead, what happened is I went to this war that I really disagreed with. I was proud to serve in, but I disagree with it. And I saw the consequences of failed leadership in Washington. I saw the consequences of people up here making decisions that affected our lives on the ground, and they had no clue. And there was a time in 2004 when a Marine in my platoon, Corporal Castro, he said, you know, sir, you ought to run for Congress someday so that this shit doesn't happen again. Now, I have to tell you, he didn't convince me because I came back, I went to business school, I went in the private sector, actually took a job in Dallas, Texas, which, by the way, if you want to run for office in Massachusetts, you don't take a job in Dallas, Texas, okay? So this was not still in my plans. But when I was down there, I got this call from Emily Cherniak, this City-er alumna who's the founder of New Politics, this organization trying to get veterans to run at a time when we've never had fewer veterans in Congress in our nation's history than we do today. And she said, you ought to run for Congress back home where you grew up in Massachusetts. I said, you're crazy. I'm living in Dallas. What are you talking about? But long story short, she's a persistent woman. She convinced me to give it a shot. And that's why I took on this 18-year incumbent in my district and ended up beating him.
And noticing being in the office, and you obviously most congressmen, women, are well-spoken. But you know how to hold the mic. And I think that's because you had a show while you were in Iraq. Can you tell us a little bit about the story?
Well, I told you how proud I was to be in the infantry, right? Mm-hmm. And I was in the first company of Marines in the Baghdad,
doing
right?
A little podcasting, you know? While you're doing infantry stuff.
Oh, my God. So, yeah, I mean, we were We were out there hooking and jabbing, and then all of a sudden, after the invasion, I suddenly find myself, you know, along with a whole bunch of other lieutenants, being enlisted in the reconstruction, because there was no plan. There was no plan at all. And so, you know, Lieutenant Martin's going to work with the fire department, and Captain Gibbs working the police, and they're like, Lieutenant Moulton, you're going to work with the Iraqi media. I'm like, what? To work with the Iraqi media?
As you expected, right?
It's crazy. I mean, I didn't know training for this. I mean, I had a like high school civics lesson.
Sure.
But I went down to City Hall, where's the governance, the provincial offices, found a radio station, the remnants of a newspaper, and a TV crew. And I was like, you know what? They always taught us that free press is fundamental to democracy. I believe that. So I guess if we're going to have a democracy in Iraq, they need a free press. And so I started working with them. And the TV station was sort of my pet project. First thing we had to do is we just had to get something on TV because they had nothing to show. So we took these pirated Chinese DVDs, bought them a DVD player, hooked it up to their massive transmitter, and they used to, imagine this, Iraqi engineers sitting around watching American movies for the first time in their lives while simultaneously broadcasting them to millions of Iraqis across the country. One of the fundamental errors we made is we didn't tell them the rating system. So one night they put in Basic Instinct.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
Interesting
they
choice.
They must have been asleep at the switch, because what they usually did is they got to a racy part of a film, they had this like 10 volume set of Islamic history videos they would put in to sort of like quiet everybody down. Well, apparently they didn't make the switch fast enough, because the next day the town was in an uproar.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, women wailing in the streets, men beating their chests, death threats. Our battalion commander was furious. I mean, look, I wasn't there. I didn't put the damn movie in the middle of the night, but you know, I was the guy in charge of the TV station, so it was my responsibility. My translator, Mohammed, and I, at the end of this brutal long day, were like, you know what? We just need a break. So we decided we'll go down and get some tea with the Iraqi police like we used to do. Because like, these are guys in their 20s and 30s. I'm sure they weren't too offended by what was on TV. I walk into the Iraqi police break room, 30 guys, furious, yelling at me.
Wow.
And I was like, well, this is going to be another cultural lesson. I turned to Mohammed and I was like, well, you know, what are they saying? And he said, sir, these policemen say that every time you put a movie on TV, you turn it off right when we get to the good part. So I truly couldn't win.
It's like you're constantly, well, you're a grown-ass man. Yeah. You don't want to watch it like your mom's there and put your hands over your eyes. We know they make out in Titanic. It's fine. Rose looked lovely on the couch.
But eventually, Mohammed and I actually, yeah, we ended up doing a few public service announcements. The Iraqis loved it. We had our own TV show. I used to get fan mail and have to sign autographs in the streets. I mean, no one asked me to do that as a congressman.
Well, Moulton and Muhammad is a great name for a TV show.
Oh, yeah, really creative, yeah.
So whenever you were there, you learned a lot more about service, I'm sure, especially with some of the things that you went through and some of the things you've seen pulling Marines out in combat situations. How did serving there influence the fact of how you serve now in Congress?
Well, first of all, as I said, I simply wouldn't be here as a congressman if not for that experience. And not just being in the Marines, I think, but being in the war and seeing what happens when people here in Washington don't know what the hell they're doing. And I try to remember that every day. You know, I had a tough campaign against this 18-year incumbent. Everyone said I couldn't win. The whole Democratic establishment was against me, all the local politicians against me and everything. Senator Warren campaigned against me. But of all the people I met, the one I remember most was a Navy veteran from World War II. He fought in the Pacific. And I shook his hand at a diner in Rowley, Massachusetts, and he said, you know, Seth, if you win this election, make sure you go to Washington as an American. Not as a Democrat or as a Republican, but as an American. And that's the kind of congressman that I try to be. Someone who's there to serve the country, not my political party, my own political interests. That's why we should all be here, because the oath that I took to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States as a United States congressman is the exact same oath, word for word, that I took as a United States Marine.
Right. So, I mean, but do you feel an added burden because you want to approach your job every day as a congressman as an American first, but having served and being a veteran? You know, oftentimes Chaps and I, our colleagues at Barstool, will default to us anytime there's any sort of military topic because, oh, what did Chaps and Connor think? Do you feel an added burden as a veteran that you have to speak up on behalf of all veterans?
Well, I do, but I never say that I speak for all veterans. Okay. I think that's presumptuous, you know?
Right.
I mean, I can't speak for everybody.
Absolutely.
But I think it's important for people here, my colleagues, to have that perspective. Mm-hmm. That's why I wanted to be on the Armed Services Committee. And it's amazing. I mean, what a great statement about our democracy that, you know, the generals that I worked for as a lieutenant, mm-hmm. right? I was a second lieutenant under Division Commander General Mattis. And now I'm the congressman who gets to ask him questions when sure. he comes before the committee as a Secretary of Defense. And I take that responsibility seriously, deadly seriously, because there are lives on the line here. Mm-hmm. I mean, don't think it doesn't bother me that here I am sitting in Congress 15 years after the invasion of Iraq, and we're still there, mm-hmm. and we can't seem to get out of it. Mm-hmm. I take responsibility for that now, and I want to make sure we finally get it right so we don't have to keep sending, you know, new Marines and soldiers back there to fight and refight the same battles that we already won and that some of our buddies lost their lives for.
So then, I'm sorry, Chip. So then what do you think about Mattis's decision to send additional troops to Afghanistan?
Well, he and I talked about it when he came before the committee last mm-hmm. week. And, you know, what I said is that I said to the secretary, you got to have a plan to win the peace, not just to win the war, because we're kind of playing whack-a-mole where we beat the insurgents down, but then right. the Afghans can't handle it themselves, and so we find ourselves back there. And I'll tell you what, I know he completely agrees with me because he's told me before, he's told me in previous testimony. And then I turned the question to Chairman Dunford, who another Marine general who's now the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and I said, is the State Department ready to do its part of the job? I mean, look, why the hell was I running a TV show in Iraq? Because the State Department wasn't there. They should have been doing that.
Right.
Right.
And again, so I said, is the State Department ready to do their job? Chairman Dunford, he didn't mince his words. He said, no, not yet.
Yeah, because they don't have a lot of undersecretaries. They
They don't have anybody in place. And they need people on the ground, too, because at the end of the day, we got to make sure that we can make the Afghan government work well enough that we can go home for good.
Yeah. I mean, some of the things that you mentioned have got to be pretty overwhelming at first whenever you first step into the role of a congressman. I would imagine it's kind of like whenever you first step in as a second lieutenant when you graduated your school, then you go get your platoon, you're like, these are actually your guys. Which one was more difficult for you to learn, dealing with the staff sergeants or dealing with the more veteran congressmen?
Look, I staff sergeants are tough, but I'd rather deal with staff sergeants than people up here. But this job, I mean, there's no more important job than, you know, the job I did in the Marines. And there's no harder job than, you know, having to do that in wartime. So Congress is tough. But anyone who says, oh, you know, Seth, is it tougher in Iraq or is it tougher here? I mean, don't get me wrong. It's, you know, it's tougher in Iraq.
And you certainly caught some flack just coming from your background, being a Harvard guy and a prep school guy a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, everybody does. Like, everybody, you know, they're going to make fun of you for whatever they can, right?
Sure.
We noticed, too, in your bio that there is a parenthetical citation, like, by your schools where you went to, which I'm still paying student loans on.
That's true.
And that was perfect.
Just for the record, you know, I'm not coming from a wealthy family. I'm not coming from a political family, either. I mean, you know, the first congressman that my parents met?
Who's that? You?
This guy, yeah. So, look, I think that when I showed up at my platoon, a lot of the guys looked at me and they said, you know, this guy's probably book smart, but he might not have any street smarts and he might get us killed. And I had to earn their trust. I think that in this job, I have to earn the trust of the people that I represent. But the Marines, I think there was a big turning point after our first firefight, because literally that night I heard a Marine in my platoon go up to a Marine in another platoon in the company and say, hey, my platoon commander went to Harvard. Where did yours go? Mm-hmm. It was like all of a sudden he was proud of it at that moment because he knew I could get him through a firefight.
No, and I have to commend you too. I mean, you were one of the first platoons in the invasion of Iraq, so there wasn't any sort of doctrine to follow prior to that. You know, obviously we've learned things in OCS and in school, but there were no...
It was the Wild West.
Exactly. You know, you guys were kind of figuring it out on the fly.
We were. And, but it was also this incredible time because, you know, by the time I was in my fourth deployment in Iraq, people were just frustrated. And, I mean, I was there in the surge and things were kind of turning around, but there were a lot of times you go back to Iraq and people are just, God, are we ever going to get this right? But during the invasion, you know, people make fun of Bush for Cheney or whoever it was for saying that we'd be greeted like liberators. But actually, that is how we were greeted by most of the people. Mm-hmm. We screwed it up later. People forget that. We screwed it up later. When we first came in, we gave the Iraqi people a taste of freedom. Mm-hmm. And even though I thought it was kind of crazy to invade, in fact, we took bets as lieutenants. We had a little pool down in Kuwait, like whether we'd actually invade. I was like, no way in hell. We're not actually going to do this. Sure enough, we did. But for that short time, the summer of 2003, I've never seen a more hopeful, optimistic, or excited place on Earth than Iraq.
Incredible. One last question that we want to ask you, and this is probably the question that we've gotten over the last year probably the most. With President Trump continuously beating down the NFL and making it almost the flag being synonymous and the national anthem being synonymous with the troops, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, it's important to say, first of all, that, like I said before, I swore an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States, both as a United States Congressman and as a United States Marine. And what the NFL players are doing, whether we like it or not, is protected under the Constitution. Right. So don't let anyone tell you that it's illegal. Mm-hmm. That is free speech. Now, we might have a different way of expressing the issue. They're speaking up because of police brutality, which is an issue. I mean, God, I have a lot of friends who are policemen, and I have great respect for their public service. But don't deny the fact that police brutality, especially against African Americans, is a problem in this country.
Right.
And we need to face it, and we need to address it. And frankly, we're not. So these guys said, we got to start a protest so that people will pay attention. The problem is the president's turned this into, he's kind of twisted it around, and now all of a sudden he's making it into a protest against the flag. That's not what the players intended, I don't think. But I will say that, you know, I wouldn't have chosen to protest in that way because it's distracting. And the problem is right now we're not talking about police brutality. We're talking about these protests. That we're talking about the protests themselves. And so we should be talking about police brutality. That's the issue.
And I think that's a larger scale of where we're at politically, is that the whataboutism that is happening now seems like it's happening more. Do you find it hard to cut through the heart of the issue of all the whataboutisms that happen in Washington? Like, for example, the bump stock that you're trying to ban. Cutting through the bullshit of the NRA and a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, because there is a lot of bullshit out there. And you know, some of my closest allies on this bump stock thing are fellow veterans.
Right.
Because they understand, like, why these laws were passed. Mm-hmm. And they understand that, you know, we all, like, I love to shoot, mm-hmm. you know? And I love to shoot. I mean, I'll shoot semi-automatic weapons. I mean, I understand that, and I understand that they're a part of our culture. But look, we don't allow you to have tanks.
Right.
We don't allow you to have
everybody
AT4s.
Everybody believes in gun control. Nobody wants to have Mod Deuce on the back of your sedan.
Exactly. So this is just reasonable stuff, and we outlawed automatic weapons. Pretty much everybody agreed with it.
Right.
Now there's a way around it, so we should fix the way around it. That's common sense. And that's why we have so many Republicans and Democrats together, actually an equal number, on this bill, because it's going to make communities safer. It's not going to solve every massacre, stop every mass shooting. But would it have prevented the extent of damage that this nutcase caused in Las Vegas? Yeah, it would have. And so that's our responsibility. And frankly, we ought to have the courage in Congress to face this issue, to face up to the NRA, to disagree where we disagree. And I think that partly as a Democrat who actually understands guns and has had to use guns and has seen the effects of gun violence, that's why I'm willing to stand up on this issue, even though I know I'm going to catch a bunch of flack for it. But
and, I mean, you just recently caught a lot of flack for the protest that you exercised.
Look, I catch flack all the time, but it's not the first time in my life. So that's part of the job.
Either
that's
wearing flacks do. Or catching it. Yeah.
No, but I feel like that is a brave thing what you did. And for those who don't know, you walked out of a moment of silence because you did not agree with that.
And look, I didn't. It's not that I didn't agree with the moment of silence. Mm-hmm. It's that the moment of silence has become an excuse for inaction, for doing nothing.
Right.
And so don't think I didn't feel bad. I mean, I feel terrible for these victims.
Sure.
And I would love to believe that we could honor them with a moment of silence and then come together, Democrats and Republicans, as Americans, and do the right thing to make our communities safer. And by the way, still respect the Second Amendment when we're doing it. Mm-hmm. But since the Republican leadership in the House right now, Speaker Ryan has shown that he's not willing to do that, I said, you know what? We need to call attention to this issue. And so that's why I stepped out. And yeah, I'm catching some flack, but I got a lot more positive responses from people across political spectrum saying, hey, at least you had the courage to say we need to do something about
it. And
this.
That's another situation where you often hear with the NFL players be like, oh, it's not the right time, it's not the right place. Well, if you're going to have a peaceful protest, you have to have something. You can't be like, well, I'm going to stand at McDonald's and right before I get my quarter pounder, I'm going to take a knee for police brutality.
You know what?
That's not going to be effectual.
You know what? A lot of people told Martin Luther King, it's not the right time.
Sure.
It's not the right place. But silence is in action. That's what this is about. Yep. And it's time we take action.
Well, Congressman, we really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk to some knuckleheads like us. Really,
hey, thanks for coming in. It's good to be with knuckleheads again. I feel like I'm one myself.
You need me to clean up before we leave?
Nah, great.
Get buff the halls out there for old time's sake.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Do you use drugs, Mr. Trammell?
Sometimes.
You ever use drugs with Mr. Boz?
Sure.
What kind of drugs?
Cocaine. Have you ever fucked on cocaine, Nick? It's nice.
Shout out to Seth Moulton for coming on the show. We appreciate him. I hope I didn't sound like a dick earlier when I gave like the preface to the interview.
No, I don't think so.
I don't want it so if you're a staffer listening, I don't want to be a dick about Seth Moulton and his stance there. It's just a very different stance that I have, and that's fine. I feel like that's totally military members can disagree on shit. If he doesn't want to tell a story ever, great, good for him. I'm going to tell mine. You're going to tell yours. We're going to tell ours. That's a big thing that this podcast is about, yeah. Actually, is talking about shit that happens in combat.
We actually kind of got to rely on those quite a bit.
Yeah.
Because that really kind of fuels this podcast.
Yeah, but I think that those events shape him, and it made it very clear that there's a reason why he wants to ban the bump stock, because they simulate weapons that you would use in war. He might not have that same perspective if he hasn't seen the destruction that a weapon like that could have.
Yeah, and one thing we didn't get into in the interview is he does a lot of work for veterans' mental health care, which is, as we know, very admirable. And I got a chance to talk to him and mentioned General Hammond from the Home Base Organization, and he said he works very closely with him. So you can rest assured that helping veterans is on the forefront of his mind and certainly one issue that he takes to heart.
Yeah, 100%. An issue that's always fresh on my mind is helping you out through betting, which you can do at MyBookie. If you're watching the game, it's time to start making money. MyBookie is the industry's leading website that hooks you up for all your betting needs. And with their great odds, fast payout, and decades of experience, you can bet those with confidence. Your team... Fuck me, I'm struggling reading. I'm having a bad reading week, folks. I apologize.
I think Chaps was starting to feel himself a little bit with the audio blogs.
Well, I'm out of practice. Yeah. I've been in the office. I haven't been doing audio blogs. If you know that your team sucks, do yourself a favor and bet against them. If they lose, you'll make money. I'm not going to bet against the Jaguars. You can if you want to, but you're going to come up moneyless like you would have last week. The core talking points are, whenever you're talking about making money, you got to know what you're talking about. You got to know what you're doing. You got to know who you're betting on, and you got to know when to get it in by. You have to get your bets in 10 minutes before kickoff by using MyBookie as a bonus. You're going to get 100% bonus when you use the promo code ZERO to activate the offer. Visit MyBookie.ag today. You win, you play, you get paid. MyBookie. Any save rounds, alibis?
Just one. I saw from our friends over at Task and Purpose that the Army is strongly considering going back to the uniforms from World War II, dress uniforms. And let me tell you, my jealousy is through the roof. Because are you going to sit there and tell me I wouldn't look dapper as hell dressing like Ben Affleck in Pearl Harbor in those khaki and greens? You kidding me?
I got to be honest with you. You guys need to stop fucking changing your goddamn uniforms.
You're right.
It's like every 6 months. I don't even, like... I've been out 5 years, and I look at y'all's uniforms. I don't even know which one's an Army uniform.
No, you're absolutely right. It does not bode well for us that we have to keep changing. It seems almost insecure that we really don't like how we look.
And the Navy pussyfoots around their changes. They want to be Marines so damn bad. They like try to be like, oh, we're the Marines are in the Department of the... Shut up, dude. Like, you change your service uniform to look like ours. You change your camouflage to look like ours, except for you make it blue.
That's
falling
terrible.
In the water, Navy?
Yeah, right?
Are you worried about falling in the water? Make your shit gray. You're on boats. They're all gray. Make them gray or black so you blend into your boats. It's not that hard. And then whenever you're attached to a Marine unit, put on some normal some normal camouflage shit like a Marpat or an Olive Jab shit. Sound the retreat. See you next week. We have Adam Kinzinger from Illinois next week. Great interview. After that, Flo. After that, Dakota Meyer. Big shit coming. Zero Block 30. Sound the retreat. Comes on the CW, and it brings to you the front line of the drama with the new military series Valor. Two special ops army helicopters break down, defying all expectations. Their bravery in the face of the impossible odds earned them distinguished distinguished. Fuck, let's start over. This week on Zero Block 30, we are going to be sponsored by a show on the CW network, the Charlie Whiskey. It's a television network that brings you the front lines drama with the new military series Valor.
Not Valley, Valor.